If you look at Board Fab, we are machinists. We are platers. We are in the photolithography industry. We run what you might call a paint line. So essentially, we have to have mastery of chemistry. We have to have mastery of the effect of temperature profiles, of machining, chip loads, tool types. We have to gain experience in a variety of materials because it's not just FR4 anymore. You've got high speed, low loss, not just for telecommunications, but now they're being introduced into the automotive world. Teflon-based materials, ceramic-based. So the list goes on and on. And that's where, you know, people can find a niche and become an expert at one thing. But if you want to grow, if you want to be a true value-add partner to your customer, you make doing business with you easier, meaning you try to solve as many of your customers' problems as possible.
That's my guest on this episode of Reliability Matters.
Welcome to Reliability Matters, a podcast for the electronic assembly industry. Each episode covers topics related to reliability, best practices, and environmentally responsible assembly techniques with insights from experts across the electronic assembly industry. Now, here's your host, Mike Conrad.
My guest is the president of several companies, all in the printed circuit board fabrication space. My guest is a graduate from the University of Michigan. He has a background in financial and operational turnaround and took over the family PCB fabrication business, Saturn Electronics Corporation. During the 2001 industry downturn, my guest rapidly adjusted his company's offerings to transform it from a low-mix, high-volume automotive supplier to a high-mix, medium-to-high-volume diversified supplier. Over the subsequent years, after reviewing the trajectory of the electronics industry, he added Saturn Flex Systems and Saturn PCB services to round out the company's product offerings so that Saturn Group could be a service to virtually any potential customer in the PCBA and OEM industries. Between all three companies, the Saturn Group is able to assist customers in the full range of PCB technologies and volumes ranging from rigid through rigid flex and HDI, and quick turn prototyping through direct support of high volume overseas-based manufacturing. Industries served include automotive, aerospace, commercial and industrial, RF microwave, and consumer. My guest is Yash Sataria. He is the president of Saturn Electronics, Saturn Flex Systems, and Saturn PCB Services, all PCB-centric operating entities. Today, we'll discuss what every buyer of printed circuit boards should be concerned about, and Yash will offer a few auditing tips that would be helpful when auditing or selecting a PCB supplier. Yash is the author of PCB Reliability, Auditing Your Supply Chain to Ensure It, a paper he presented at SMTAI last year. Welcome, Yash. Thanks for joining me today.
Thank you.
Yash, you are involved in the board fabrication business. I'm involved in taking your products and adding things to it. So, you know, the whole world starts with you and your industry. You're ground zero.
Well, aren't you more like taking away things from it?
Well, that's true. That's true. When we get into the micro, yeah. Absolutely. Yes. We're taking away all the stuff you left behind and everyone else added on. We're cleaning up after you. But certainly your industry, the board fabrication industry, is ground zero for the electronic assembly process. Caught my attention, how I discovered you, was I read one of your papers that you published at SMTAI last year in 2018, entitled PCB Reliability, Auditing Your Supply Chain to Ensure It. And in the abstract, you state PCBs are electronic real estate, establishing the foundation for assembly. There is a direct correlation between the reliability of a final electronic product and the bare printed circuit board. There is much more to knowing what it takes as both a buyer and a producer of circuit boards to ensure high reliability PCB performance. So to put a twist on the famous line from the movie Jerry Maguire, you had me at reliability. Before we begin jumping into what it takes to properly fabricate a reliable circuit board, let's turn the conversation toward your direction specifically. And tell me a little bit about you, how your life before Saturn Electronics and how you entered the board fab space.
Oh, well, that's a long and a short story. So my dad started Saturn in 1985, and I think I was it's a week before my 10th birthday. So it's a family business. I think he broke a couple labor laws and had me start working when I was 14, basically the worst job you can have in any place in the factory.
Advantage of a family business.
Yeah, essentially every vacation, summer break, winter break, you name it, from high school all the way through college, I was here. And as soon as I graduated business school, I said, I never want to see circuit boards again. So I went into consulting, valuation, then into bankruptcy turnaround, getting into financial efficiencies, operational efficiencies, so forth. And eventually I figured, you know, I've been working since I was 14. I don't like working here anymore. I'm going to take a break. 2 months later, my mom found me and made me go work for my dad again. So I've been here ever since. And that was May 2001.
Wow. I noticed in your bio that, you know, you have experience in education in the turnaround business, as you just mentioned. I guess that's one advantage of running your own company with that experience. You can make sure you don't get turned around once in the first place, right? Because you can see what everyone else has done wrong.
You know, you would think, but I think the key takeaway from that was staying focused. When you're in a situation, and typically there were operational issues that we would run into. Companies are facing bankruptcy, and you lose sight of your original mission, and you're too busy putting out fires, trying to keep the lights on, things like that. And unfortunately, if you look at most bankruptcies, they never come back. There's no such thing as a turnaround. And that was kind of a big impetus for me to leave that industry because it was just depressing after a while. And then when I started, it was 2001. We were in the start of a pretty decent recession, and China came on in a big way. And from the bare board side, I believe in 2000, we were about a $12 billion industry. By the end of 2002, we were sub $4 billion. And so essentially the walls were coming down all around us. And at least the main takeaway from the training and the previous consulting was staying calm. Let's figure out what's going on, how to address it, and move forward. And that's exactly what we did. We were an automotive supplier, high volume, low mix, which is exactly what China is good at. And essentially, I think in a 3 week period at the end of 2001, we lost half our sales.
Wow.
And you know, most people don't recover, you know, from an automotive supplier standpoint. I've seen people with a 10% drop in sales end up in bankruptcy. It's that sensitive of a margin. So I'd say we did a pretty good job recovering. And basically, we converted ourselves to be a high mix. And instead of low or medium volume, we still retain high volume capability along with running two panel 24-hour turns all the way through volume production. So we do have a unique footprint in North America now.
Yeah, it sounds like that. Your industry, probably along with the semiconductor industry, would be considered the tip of the spear in terms of leading economic indicators for the electronic assembly industry. If you get slow, we get slow very shortly thereafter.
Right. I mean, that follows the supply chain.
Right. And you're kind of the head of that. Tell me a little bit more about Saturn Electronics. You mentioned that, the type of work you do. I know you do automotive work, which is a very specialized form of work. You have to have special certifications, et cetera. But tell me about the types of business you do and where you do it.
Right. So, you know, in 2000, we're about 90% automotive. Today, maybe 15%. The mix is really quite broad. We have large customers in the military aerospace arena, probably about 30% of our sales now. Industrial controls, probably about 15% of our sales. LED markets, about 10%. And then the balance is spread across numerous contract manufacturers and other OEMs across the industry.
Very good. That diversification probably makes your bank happy. No one likes concentrations.
Well, it lets me sleep well at night.
Better than Ambien.
You have to have a lot of work go into it. You know, we had the back then it was QS, then it changed to TS-16949. Now it's AITF-16949 for automotive, the aerospace AS9100D, along with the 14,000 for environmental. So we're heavily certified, and that requires a lot of resources in the background. So it's an easy story to run through, but just tons and tons of work that had to go into it. But, you know, kind of like the circuit board, you know, it's your foundation. These certs, these procedures, these quality checks, that's our foundation. So, you know, people say, what's your focus? It's not a technology. It's not an industry. It's high reliability. And whoever needs that, that's who we build for, regardless of your industry is, and regardless of what your technology is, you know, we've bolted on capabilities over the years. So, and again, you know, we never lost sight of the focus being a high rel supplier.
And you build boards right here in the U.S., I believe in Michigan, and also overseas. Is that correct?
Well, so we're based right outside of Detroit, and with respect to overseas, we're like a lot of the folks in the U.S. where we have partner facilities where we'll buy and resell. But we've taken that to a next level, something that no one else really I know has done. But we've actually, instead of being in front of the overseas supplier, trying to basically be the only person that the customer interfaces with, we've stepped to the side and we've aligned ourselves with the seventh largest PCB manufacturing group in the world. They're a division of Kingboard. So we work with two of their facilities. One is a Hi-Rel automotive supplier, primarily on the rigid side. And the other, I think they used to be one of the world's largest HDI manufacturers. They're still up there, but we've actually collaborated with them to teach them how to do rigid flex. So they're developing volume HDI rigid flex capabilities that we partner with them in terms of, instead of buying and reselling, we actually support them. So the customer deals directly with them, and we provide local quality engineering technical support. And at the benefit for Saturn is we're still at the front seat. And so we get the benefit of doing a lot of the development work, being their emergency guys. When they have a need for volume at a quick turn, we're one of the few shops in the U.S. that can do that still. So it's a unique situation, but definitely beneficial for all parties.
And yeah, it sounds like a unique collaborative partnership between a customer and their supplier, which only benefits your customer, I would suppose. Okay, let's jump into the article you wrote. You know, I just wake up every morning thinking circuit boards are just somehow, you know, hatched by geese or something, and they just come down from heaven, and they're just there. You know, I am completely unaware of, or ignorant even of, the in-depth processes that go on to fabricate these boards. I just know a little bit about it. I certainly know what can go wrong. I also know that anytime the assembly process goes wrong, people tend to, you know, blame
always the board
downstream. Right. Well, it must be a bad board. Right. Exactly. The components are falling off. There's voiding. Must be a bad board. So in your article, you lay out some of the key points, and I'll just kind of bullet point those, and then we can kind of go through it. You talk about laminates and multi-layer pressing and failure modes and press control checklists and drilling and copper plating and my favorite subject, cleaning. Walk me through the PCB fabrication process and what aspects of that process should customers ordering boards be concerned with and possibly inspect for?
So I think we could take a step back. And when it comes to, you know, really the intent of this article was to give customers, specifically those, you know, in the position to qualify a supplier, some inside tips, if you will, of things to look for. You know, in our history, we've been audited God knows how many times by, you know, whether it's the certification bodies and more specifically customers. And unfortunately, a lot of them have a one size fits all audit sheet. It may be based on ISO or TS systems, and or even worse, there's a common document called the IPC 1710, which to me is more like a capabilities matrix as opposed to a true audit form. But that's the tools that they have, and there's very easy ways to get through those audits and pass fairly well without lending towards gaining, you know, what degree of reliability of product can these people generate? And if you look at the fab process, it's quite painstaking. It's intricate, many steps, each of those steps having different failure modes. And most importantly, it requires a mastery of a variety of disciplines. You know, when I was in automotive, I thought it was hard. I said, wow, you got to do a lot of these parts and good quality. But if you're a stamper, you're a stamper, you're hitting metal. If you're a molder, you're a molder, you're shooting plastic. And maybe you add a paint line, maybe you add a little bit of final assembly. If you look at board fab, we are machinists, we are platers. We are in the photolithography industry. We run what you might call a paint line. So essentially, we have to have mastery of chemistry. We have to have mastery of the effect of temperature profiles, of machining, chip loads, tool types. We have to gain experience in a variety of materials because it's not just FR4 anymore. You've got high speed, low loss, not just for telecommunications, but now they're being introduced into the automotive world. Teflon-based materials, ceramic-based. So the list goes on and on. And that's where, you know, people can find a niche and become an expert at one thing. But if you want to grow, if you want to be a true value add partner to your customer, you make doing business with you easier, meaning you try to solve as many of your customers' problems as possible. So that's where, you know, we kind of, you know, made our turnaround. We learned to do what we didn't know how to do. And that's really where, you know, it becomes a challenge for customers to audit, because now, you know, when you're an assembler, you're dealing with two layers, top and bottom. There can be 20 layers in between. There's things going on that on an assembly level you're not used to, like chemistries, like material properties, things like that. And I seem to have gotten way out of line from the original question.
No, that's perfect. And that it brought up another question that I wasn't planning on asking. How much of the board fab business is art versus science? I know obviously it's science, but how much of the process is just art form, just being artisans at what you do?
So, you know, that comes down to how you skin the cat. And that's another reason why it's important to audit your supplier, because the board business can range from everything manual, where you're hugely operator dependent, through, you know, some of the most automated processes where you have basically people just watching machines run. And in my view, unfortunately, the more I take people out of the process, the better results I have with respect to uniformity and quality. So, you know, so the answer is basically yes and yes and no and no. It can be as operator dependent and as much of an artisan project as the fabricator has the capability to do. And it can be a fully automated process. And really that is driven by customer design. And, you know, a lot of designers, they're looking at everything at 1000x magnification. They say, hey, everything looks good. But in real life, it can be quite a challenge. So in our business, we're fairly automated, but you get designs where, gosh, this is going to be something that we call it a hand walker. We're going to have to walk it hand by hand with a technician or an engineer step by step to make sure that we achieve the desired result.
Do you ever have a customer ask for something that either hasn't been done yet or, in your opinion, just can't be done, and you have to sit down with them and collaborate and redesign certain portions of it? Does that come up from time to time?
All the time. You know, when I was younger and had more energy, I never said no. And a lot of times I got myself into trouble, but we ended up building the boards. And now there's people out there that say, okay, well, this is something that hasn't been done. We know it shouldn't be done, but let's just call Yash. So I still get myself into trouble, but now I have a lot more help around me. But there are other cases where folks design, especially nowadays more frequently, because now that we have the flex, rigid flex operation in-house, a lot of folks are going from a rigid design to a rigid flex, and it's their first time, second time. So we constantly say, listen, just throw together your concept and then let us help take it over. And we'll go through it, run the DFMs, get on the call with their designer, screen shares, share with them, here's the suggestions for improvement, here's requirements to make it buildable, things like that to really get it done. We actually had a recent project where this poor guy had four rigid boards that he was wiring together with actual wire and hand solder for a bariatric surgery device. And in the end, they're supposed to go to 100,000 units a year. And I said, my God, how are you going to achieve this reliably and consistently? So we actually, unfortunately, had to work over Christmas, but we helped them design almost from scratch a two-layer flex board with stiffeners that exactly met their purpose, cut their assembly cost by, I think, about 70% from the labor standpoint. And they've actually are in phase two FDA trials right now. So we've had some really good success stories over the years.
Wow, that's great. Okay, walk me through the audit process, if you will. What should buyers of circuit boards be asking their suppliers? What should they be checking on? In a generic sense, I know it varies industry by industry, and sure. Expectations of reliability and where the boards are going, the climactic end use environment, et cetera. But as a generic rule, what should buyers be asking? Are there questions they should be asking? Are there things they should be auditing? Are there things at least they should be inspecting?
Okay, well, let's start with the asking. I always tell buyers, you know, there's no magic in this industry. And you see pricing that's 20, 30% below with one vendor than all the rest, you should be asking the question, why? How are you able to achieve this? You know, the vendors in China, I always say they should all be within plus minus 10% of each other, and as well as the ones domestically, right? There, unless you're either giving it away or you're cutting corners, and cutting corners seems to be something that's very common overseas, and I don't know that it's necessarily malicious. I tend to believe, even though overseas has the vast majority of the volume, they're still a younger industry, and it's a young population that's in these board houses. And they still have a decent amount to learn. So, you know, they may not even be asking the questions, you know, of their own vendors. You know, part of that article, I talked about laminates, for example. And the way we learned our lesson, we used to all think, hey, it's double-sided laminate. It's basically your run-of-the-mill stuff. Everybody should be the same. And I had a vendor call me. And he said, hey, I've got this really good material and your guy won't let me send him samples to test. And so he had someone like turning down free material. So I said, okay, that's probably not super weird. What makes your material so much better? He said, it's very good laminate and I'm 20% cheaper than your current vendor. I said, well, that's probably why he doesn't want you to send it in. He doesn't want you to waste his time. And so he was a friend of mine. So I said, fine, I'll force him to test it out. And he did a simple test that it's not common to do on rigid materials, but he did a solder float, tried to do a time to delam. And so he took our existing material, which, you know, it's just, again, normal material, put it on a solder pot. And after 30 minutes, basically nothing happened and he got bored and took it off. Then he took a sample of this new material, threw it on the solder pot. And within 5 minutes, all of the surface copper had disintegrated into the solder and the resin holding the fiberglass sheets together all not only disintegrated, but almost ignited and basically burnt to a char, and every single piece of fiberglass delaminated from the laminate. So, you know, right there, you have a hugely significant difference in the quality of the material that, you know, you're talking about resistance to heat. You're talking about interlaminate adhesion. Those are all direct contributors to long-term reliability. And again, it depends on the application, but I would probably venture to assume that even if you're not in a high stress environment, like on the engine, under a hood, in a plane, if you're making industrial controls, you still care about the long-term reliability of your product. If you're doing LEDs, you still care. And those are, you know, things that wouldn't be something that definitely not a PCB buyer would be asking about. But, you know, quite frankly, even on the bare board fabrication side, it's not a common test. But, you know, my buyer asked the question, why are you so cheap? And then he dug further and tested it out. So that's a really, really valid example of questioning a price.
Yeah, no better example than you get what you pay for. I think part of the problem, a lot of people will blame the suppliers overseas, and that's probably a valid complaint. But I think there's a cultural issue on this side of the ocean, on our side, where we just are under the impression that anything made in Asia is cheap. And we kind of force them to drive down the costs, and it is a race to the bottom. And I think if, you know, somehow one day we were all to wake up and just decide we're going to pay for the value we receive, whatever that happens to be, then, you know, suddenly the world would be a better place. Everything would be more reliable. But I think it's a combination of cutting corners, as you stated, and that's fueled by our insatiable desire for the lowest possible cost.
Right.
And we can't have both.
I was shocked to hear this statement. This was many years ago by an automotive purchasing manager. And clearly he didn't have too much knowledge, but he said, listen, because we tried to push, you know, look at us, look at our vendors overseas, their quality, we're audited, certified, blah, blah, blah. And he said, listen, I assume quality and I assume good delivery. So that's why I go only by price, which you couldn't sum up a more dangerous statement than that. And like you said, you know, this assumption, and really it's closing eyes and hoping for the best, it has really done a number on board pricing globally. And like you said, if you in Asia, you need to be at 80-90% loading capacity to make money easily. And, you know, they have no choice but to get the order. So they'll cut the price and then they'll figure out how to make money. And that's where, you know, you get, you know, random material substitutions, you'll get chemistry substitutions, you'll get, hey, maybe we don't need this many checks or this many inspections, or maybe we could cut our chemical testing down to twice a week instead of daily. You know, there's a lot of ways you could cut costs because you're talking about trying to shave off fractional percentages at that point.
Sure. In the words of Ronald Reagan, who, according to the Russians, they coined the phrase, but trust but verify, right?
Right.
Don't. And we can also coin those, you know, the saying about what happens when you assume.
Yes, yeah. Yes.
How's assume spelled? You make an ass of you and me. So exactly. Agreements are much better than trust, and follow up and control helps verify the process. So we talked about laminates. What other attributes of a board or functions of board fabrication should buyers be concerned about?
Okay. Well, so I like to talk about these aspects as the backbone of reliability of a PCB. There's probably, I think, 42 individual steps you go through to make a two-layer PCB, even more for a multi-layer, even more for HDI and sequential LAM. So what I try to do is boil it down to something simple that, you know, if you're going to do all these technologies, that's fine, but you got to get these four basics right to begin with. So you have your material selection. And then for multi-layer processes, you have to bond these materials together. And it seems simple. You apply temperature and pressure, and you're bonding layers together to make a multi-layer. And one of the things I found out was in Asia, a lot of people, especially the medium and smaller shops, they don't even have their own lamination facilities in-house. They outsource the whole thing. And, from our standpoint, we have it in-house. We have a QC engineer assigned to that process because it's so critical and so machine dependent. You're looking at your recipes in terms of what's your starting temperature, what's your rate of rise of temperature from start to cure temperature, time at cure temperature, and rate of decrease. Those all affect the final reliability of the PCB. And that's us having it in-house, having a full-time person there. And over there, they outsource. So my question to one of the vendors we had visited was, well, so how do you audit your supplier? And he pulled out an ISO cert. And, that was it. They're certified. We're good. So there was a trust, but no verify. And, from that standpoint, ISO, TS, IATF certs, I think they almost hand them out like toilet paper in China. And, my vendor, he made the same comment and he said, the trick is everybody has an automotive IATF cert. Ask them what programs they're on, and you'll find that the vast majority, especially the middle and smaller shops, they don't have any automotive work. They just got the cert. And I guess we could take a quick step back and explain why I actually went on this audit. This was when my dad was still around, and we got a call from one of our customers that said, "Hey, how you doing? Everything's good. By the way, you owe us $1.2 million. And we said, "What?" And it was basically we had launched a program, backup camera, and it required a small board. It required a small board. We did the launch and we had a lot of fallout, and we found out that the vias were suspect. So they sorted them out, continued launch because you can't miss a launch in automotive. And we ended up paying $120,000 for the launch issues. And we thought the issue was done. But what they did was anytime there was a customer return in the field that had a similar resulting issue, meaning like the camera was fuzzy or camera didn't work, they automatically assigned it to that failure mode. And so over the course of the 3-year warranty period, they just kept adding it up on the side and gave us the bill for $1.2 million. In the end, it was negotiated down to about $600,000, but that was based on $1,250 worth of circuit boards that we sold them. So all of a sudden, auditing became a big issue. We had assigned one person here to audit our overseas vendors. And at that point, my dad said, "You know what? I don't want to do this. I don't want to rely on these people anymore. You need to go with me over there," because I hadn't been there in 10 years. So that's what started this. So first we asked the lamination, find out it's all outsourced. Okay, that's not good. You need to verify. The next thing we did was we look at drilling, and that's where we're drilling component holes, but more importantly, the via holes. These are very small holes that make your connection, not just from top to bottom, but all your inner layers. And vias are one of the most common failure modes for a board that has an open at the end of assembly. It's a small hole. We're trying to plate into the hole, and that hole has to survive some sort of thermal cycling and still make a robust connection. So number one, in order to plate a hole well, you actually have to have a well-drilled hole, smooth hole quality, very good interconnect quality. And that's really controlled by a combination of the quality of the drill bit. Is it sharp? Is it centered? As well as the parameters you use to drill. What's the RPM? What's the feed rate going into the material? What's the feed rate coming out of the material? And what's the maximum number of holes you can drill? So this is where, it goes back to your, is it art or is it manufacturing? And it can be both, depending on the how you run your drill room. Older machines, you manually plugged everything in, or it's part of a header of the program. Now, these parameters change with material types, with layer counts, with total ounces of copper. So there's quite a few inputs there. And so from our side, we have drill room software. We invested six figures into software where the front end, they just plug in key parameters, whether it's layers, material types, so forth. And the software chooses based on the those parameters, what those drilling parameters will be. And that gets loaded automatically into the machine. The operator is removed. So, you know, I went to the drill room over there. So the first part, the lamination audit, took 5 minutes. We go to the drill room. We ask, okay, what are your feeds and speeds? And they said, oh, well, here, they're on a piece of paper. So every drill room has this four or five pages stapled together, and it has by each diameter what their RPM, their feed rate, their retract rate, and their hit count supposed to be. And so I say, oh, so how do they get input into the machine? The operator does it. I say, okay, I guess I can accept that because it's their process and they're theoretically auditing to that process. So my next question was, well, I only see like standard FR4 here. What about like high temp FR4? And they turned to the last page and it was a single line item. And it said, reduce feed rate by 30%. I said, okay, that seems simple, but I guess if you've developed your process and you've done the testing, it must be okay for you. And they said, yes, of course. So I said, okay, that's interesting. I'm looking around your entire drill room and I don't see a handheld calculator. Do you expect your operators to do this in their head? Then all the questions, you know, the looks go around, and then all of a sudden a calculator shows up. I said, okay, fine. So I took the next step, and I know how to run a drilling machine because my dad made me work in all the processes here, but that's not something an auditor would do or know about. But I said, hey, show me the parameter page on this machine that's running. And so they pulled it up, and it was running a high temp lead-free capable laminate, so you had to apply that 30%. And so I just ran the math, and I said, gosh, none of these match. And then all of a sudden there's more confusion, and then I get an excuse. Oh, this is a special job, requires slightly different parameters. But in the end, these guys didn't give their own operators the tools that they needed to follow their system. It was actually kind of funny.
Yeah, I know with drilling, I was involved. I think we spoke about this during the pre-interview. I was involved in a civil litigation matter as a hired gun, so to speak, a hired expert witness, where they had a CAF issue, conductive anodic filament issue. And the folks on the other side were blaming everybody, but part of the blame went to the fabricator. And they said their drills were dull, or they were applying too much, and or they were applying too much pressure, and or they were rotating too slow, whatever. And it was causing little tears and micro cracks between the layers. And then they also blamed the laminate process. They said there was dry weave and, you know, blame. The fabricator kind of got thrown under the bus for something that a simple bakeout process could have prevented in the first place. Even with all those sins of the process occurring, a simple bakeout process would have at least eliminated the CAF issue, even though the other constituent requirements were there. So, you know, the little bit I know about board fabrication, drilling is certainly, at least from that standpoint, and I'm sure many others, an important factor.
Well, absolutely. But, you know, I mean, you bring up a good point. There's a saying, we're all in this together, right? And we should all be doing our parts to apply best practices as much as possible. And that's board fab as well as assembly. And sure, maybe there's some things that are a best practice on assembly side that is opening up a process window for perhaps a potential deficiency on the fab side. And fine, it's easy to blame the fab side, but boy, if we all did everything best practices, assembly can make up for a deficiency on the fab side, and quite certainly fab side can make up for deficiencies on the assembly side. You know, building an extra robust board It can make up for temperature spikes in reflow. It can make up for a higher required peak reflow temperature. It can make up for thermal shocks. It can make up for extended dwells, mid-assembly, things like that. So, you know, I really think that, you know, the word partnership is overused and underutilized. But collaborations can go a long way for sure.
A lot of assemblers assume their boards are completely clean. If we're going to rate cleanliness on a scale of 0 to 10, they'll assume it's a 0 because nothing's been added to the board. Nothing's been soldered. The board hasn't been handled. It comes off the container ship, wrapped in plastic, and it's at a 0. It's perfectly clean. If one tests incoming boards for cleanliness, they'll find out that in most cases, they're never at 0. They're at something, not high.
There's no such thing as zero.
Right, exactly. Just environmentally, just sitting on a ship, whatever, and being handled by the fabricators and the machinery adds some level of stowaway contamination. How many customers of yours are concerned about cleanliness of the bare board as it enters their facility? And if there are customers that are concerned about that, what processes are the boards put through to address that concern?
Okay. Well, I can say that if I ask my customers, are you concerned with cleanliness? Everybody will say yes. And then if I ask a follow-up question, since you're concerned, do you specify cleanliness levels? And out of 300 active customers, I can only count 3 that can say yes. And really, you know, the cleanliness is determined, at least on the bare board. One level is ionic contamination. And if you look at the IPC 6012, from my memory at least, the only ionic contamination callout is prior to solder mask application. Well, the biggest issues that are created by ionic contamination are created by ionic contamination that's on the solder mask itself. So we're really not required to test for that, which is surprising. So it really goes to process knowledge and product knowledge. And the customers that do require it are you know, probably not and consequently have built their own boards in the past, have that product knowledge, and have done life cycle testing, life cycle development for different applications. So, it's unfortunate. And also, you know, IPC has come out with a cleanliness specification, but it's separate than the 6012. So unless you call it out specifically in your fab notes, really no one has to meet it.
Right. So if they do have to meet it, is that on the receiver's end to clean the board, or is that on the fabricator's end to provide aftermath cleaning?
It's an as received condition that we're supposed to be meeting, and so if we do need to meet it, we go through a certain number of extra steps here. So typically it's hardest to meet ionic contamination requirements when you have a solder finish. So tin lead solder or lead free solder. The reason being is that the fluxes used in that process are the largest contributor towards ionic contamination levels. So there's additional cleaning requirements, and I know this is speaking to your trade there. So we have built specialized equipment that can accept saponifiers into a cleaning bath, have special scrubbing brushes to really grind those saponifiers into the board surface to break up those fluxes, then high temperature RO or DI water used to spray them clean. That's a big step that we took towards meeting, at least on the automotive side, ionic contamination requirements. But also, it's your facilities in general. Are you using RO or DI water in critical processes? Are you using gloves? Are you Are your rinsing agents kept clean by, you know, either a running bailout or a scheduled changeovers, things like that? And so typically when there's an ion contamination requirement, we're running either an ionograph or an ion chromatograph test prior to shipment and sending that certification with the boards.
Very good. You know, BMW just was in the news in an unflattering way just a couple of weeks ago. And it was actually in the mainstream press, which really surprised me because it was you know, our industry involved. They had to recall lots of cars because, according to them, one of the circuit boards in the car was shutting down because of a voltage leak. And they determined that one of their tier two suppliers, assembly suppliers, not board fab suppliers, didn't clean the boards properly. And you know, that's kind of the, we all know this happens because we're in this industry. It's the first time I've really seen that impact on a mass scale in mainstream news. You know, it's like, yeah, I know all about that, you know, but certainly affected BMW, and I'm sure that they will be in discussions with their tier two supplier, assembly supplier, about how to correct that problem. And like you guys got probably some kind of bill associated with that later.
Right. You know, it's unfortunate that it takes catastrophic issues for people to actually learn about their products that they're buying and incorporating into their own product. But, you know, as of late, I would say as of the last probably 3-4 years, we've seen a much higher degree of interest at the, you know, let's keep on the automotive page from the OEMs. Prior to that, the people buying boards were tier twos and tier threes. Tier ones and tier twos were the board buyers. And the OEMs really never paid any attention to it. Maybe about 10 years ago, they started having some more attention because of the higher use of electronics. But really, we were getting calls from, and we're in Detroit, so it was Ford, GM, Chrysler. It was primarily Ford took the early seat, was trying to get in here to understand the process, but not for reliability's sake, but from a cost standpoint. They wanted to figure out a way they could push cost reductions down to their suppliers. And more recently, we've had Ford and Chrysler engineering teams in here, not from a cost basis, but to learn about, you know, what goes into a board build, how does design impact, and how can this impact long-term reliability? So people are starting to wake up. And unfortunately, it probably takes stories like that BMW situation to set off the alarm.
Well, that certainly increases my faith in the automotive industry. That's very encouraging. I've had a late model car, and I have an old model car. I have a 1968 Mustang, and I seem to say this in every podcast. So for those listeners that are tired of hearing this story, I apologize, but it kind of falls perfectly into this scenario. My 68 Mustang, if 100% of the circuit assemblies failed, I would only not be able to listen to my AM radio, right? Because that's the only circuit board in the car. Everything else is electrical. There's nothing else electronic. Right. On my 2018 late model GM product, if any of the circuit boards fail, I could not be able to steer, not be able to brake. It could detect falsely that I'm about to veer off a road and turn my steering wheel for me. It could do all sorts of nasty things that could affect my safety. In an industry, the automotive industry specifically, where there is certainly a level of price consciousness, and now that electronics are more than infotainment, now that they are major safety devices, there's a kind of a perfect storm, this collision coming of how cheap can we build this product and how well can we build this product. And I think all the automotive companies are waking up to the fact that reliability is a lot more than just having the car start in the morning. It is now not killing the driver or people around or causing property damage due to a malfunction.
Right. And I do see a look across, you know, in other industries, what can happen to automotive can happen to industrial controls, for example. Maybe it's not, it could be a safety issue. If your PLC, for example, is controlling a production line and there's a failure on a safety mechanism, it could hurt someone more. But more commonly, if your PLC fails, you could have a complete line down issue. And, you know, at the automotive level, line down is $2 million an hour. And so a lot of folks are looking at reliability, and I'm sensing there's a shakeout happening, you know, stateside sub 300 board fabricators, maybe even in the 200 level. Overseas, I've heard up to 5,000 fabricators in China alone. And everybody was busy. But now that people are auditing or looking at reliability, they've narrowed the scope of potential vendors, which means, you know, the people that were doing a good job are busier. But unfortunately, the people that weren't doing such a great job probably have a lot of open capacity, and they are just clamoring for business. Anybody in the board business probably gets 10, 20 spam emails every morning. I'm Lucky Blue, and I'm here to provide you with PCBs. And they are cutting each other's throats. And unfortunately, the price levels that they're offering are so attractive. People, again, you know, in other industries or that aren't so knowledgeable are sometimes closing their eyes and saying, yeah, why not? And, I think it's going to, the reliability issues that we've seen in the automotive world are probably going to start festering their way towards many other industries as those people become more and more aggressive on the price level.
I get about, without exaggeration, 8 or 9 or 10 invites daily on my LinkedIn page to easily connect with a board supplier.
Yep.
It's insatiable, the appetite for them to connect to people here. There's just so many of the board suppliers there. But it's good to hear that there is a kind of a new dawn of awareness of reliability, because as you said, as we discussed, it really, electronics now impact, they have a greater impact on society. They're omnipresent and they're ubiquitous and they're everywhere. And particularly with Internet of Things, with IoT, we're dragging electronics along with us on our bodies, in our clothing, in our cars, obviously, and on everything we carry. So reliability is way more impactful today than it was 10 years ago, 20 years ago, 30 years ago.
Yes, electronics not working is not just a nuisance anymore.
Correct. Absolutely. Where do you see, we're going to wrap up, and there are so many other kind of audit points that were brought up in your article, and I'm going to provide a link to your article so that SMTA members can download it for free on the SMTA.org website. Can't remember if they're .org or .com, but you can find it. Search the title of the article, which is PCB Reliability Auditing Your Supply Chain to Ensure It. It'll pop right up. If you're an SMTA member, you can download that article for free, and you can kind of dive deep into all the different audit points and points of concern and questions you should be asking your supplier. So we talked about the past, how electronics were less ubiquitous in the past and less harmful if they failed. Where do you see the electronics industry 5 to 10 years from now, either the board fab industry or the electronic industry in general?
Yeah, I wish I could tell you where it would be 5 months from now. the one of the things that keeps me interested in this industry is change. It's hard to see what's around the corner. Folks used to say, oh, everything's getting higher tech. Sure. But then a lot of low tech work came in on the LED side and created a whole new sub industry. And that's what keeps it dynamic. And that's why, you know, we always try to position ourselves as trying to be ready for just about anything. The only thing that I can say with confidence is I do feel that the customer base is trying to become more intelligent about what they're buying, is trying to become more particular about who they use for what application, which is overall a great thing because, you know, we're not drinking through a fire hose anymore. You know, when electronics started coming on strong, it was just tons of new applications. We were scrambling to find a supply chain that fit. And now everything's at a little bit relatively more calm level. And I do see that a lot of these issues that we talk about in the past where, you know, it just comes down to a bad supply or a bad process, I have the feeling that the customers that are putting in a little bit of work now are going to see huge dividends in the future.
Yeah, certainly we are, I like to say, we are at an evolution stage in electronics, not a revolution stage in electronics. We are, you know, pretty much everything we're building now is a variant of something we've built before. It is smaller, it is faster, it is more critical, but there's less revolution and certainly a lot more evolution going on.
Which is the normal course of things. And
of course.
Stability brings a great opportunity for refinement. We actually converted this article into a webinar that I believe it's on our site, available for viewing if folks want a more narrated version as opposed to reading a semi-abridged article.
How do our listeners find that webinar?
The webinar is posted on our website, or they can just email Sean, S-E-A-N, at SaturnElectronics.com, and he'll be happy to send them the link.
Sean, S-E-A-N, at SaturnElectronics.com. Very good. We love webinars. I love that style of delivery. You get to see, you get to hear. It's almost kinesthetic. It's for me, it's more gets in than when I just read an article. So I'll highly recommend
our
listeners.
Aren't nearly as good as yours, I can tell you that.
No. This is great. You are a fountain of information. And I have to say that the people I enjoy interviewing the most are people that have passion for their business. And they don't just kind of drone on about, you know, whatever, bullet point, bullet point, bullet point.
If you're not passionate about your business, you're in the wrong business.
Absolutely. I totally agree. I'm very fortunate that the people that I get to interview, including yourself, that passion just ekes out, and it's very difficult to ignore. It's right out there. So I appreciate what you do for this industry. I think if our customers were receiving boards from Saturn or companies like Saturn that know what they're doing, there'd be fewer issues that we'd be blamed for. Just from a selfish standpoint, it's like quality in, quality out. So I'm grateful for what you guys do, and I'm extremely grateful for you spending the last almost 1 hour with me talking about the audit points and the criticalities of board fabrication. Thanks, Yash. I really appreciate it.
And let me pass that back on to you. What work you're doing is excellent. And I wish there were more of you out there because, you know, we have new generations of board buyers, decision makers coming on board. And the more information that's, you know, and this new generation has to be easy, quick, and meaningful. I think the more this knowledge will continue on. We're on a record breaker here because this is probably the first interview or presentation I've ever done that I haven't uttered a swear word.
Well, the moment I stop recording, they'll just come screaming out, right? Yeah, this could be like the Howard Stern version of of technical podcasts. Maybe that'll be the next generation of them. But we certainly, in this industry, this is, you know, I have a lot of friends who are not in this industry, so they just don't get this. But I like to complain that we're in the, you know, virtually the only industry where the products we sell, the electronic assemblies that are sold, are expected to be twice as fast, half the size, and half the price, and last twice as long year over year over year over year.
Well, you know what? You asked for a prediction 5 years from now. I bet you we'll all be wishing people were paying half the price.
Half the price from today. Yeah, exactly.
Exactly.
Our industry is, I just as an aside, I went to a friend's wedding in Florida a few years ago, and they are in the electronics industry. And we had probably about 35 people from the electronics assembly industry there, from presidents of pick and place companies, x-ray companies, reflow oven companies, et cetera. And I made a joke that you know, if God forbid terrorists drop a bomb on this wedding reception, the entire electronics industry is going to be wiped out. You know, because the industry has gotten so consolidated over the years. You know, 30 years ago, 1985, actually, when I got into this industry, you know, we would go to a trade show, there'd be 1,500, 2,000 exhibitors taking every exhibit hall plus tents plus hotels, you know, all that.
I hear the stories.
Yeah. Now we're half a hall or at best, the large, you know, maybe Prototronica has, you know, four halls, but it's nothing compared to what it used to be. Yet there's probably more dollars involved in the industry in terms of, you know, total net worth of the industry with a fraction of the players. And it's a very interesting business, as you know, getting dragged into it by your parents. And it is a very interesting industry, but it's the one we're in, and it's fascinating in many ways. And it does certainly produce curse words daily basis. Well, thanks for not using those here. Again, thanks for your time, Yash. It's greatly appreciated.
Well, that's another episode. Thanks for listening to Reliability Matters. If you like what you hear, please be sure to give us a like. Just click the like or heart button below. If there are any reliability-based questions you'd like to have answered or specific topics discussed, let me know. I can be reached at mike@mikeconrad.com. That's Conrad with a K. Don't miss another episode. Subscribe to Reliability Matters on iTunes or follow us on Spotify. You can also listen to us on iTunes, Spotify, AqueousTech.com, PCBChat.com, Spreaker.com, or our newest affiliate, Ascendo Reliability, on reliability.fm, a site dedicated to all things reliability. Once again, thanks for listening. We'll be back soon with another episode of Reliability Matters. In the meantime, keep doing it right.
Thanks for listening to the Reliability Matters podcast. Join us on the second and fourth Tuesday of each month for new episodes of Reliability Matters.